Well, good morning. My name is Sissy, and I'm one of the pastors here, and it is a joy to be with you this morning. We are in the middle of a series that we've entitled Surprised by Grace, where we have been discovering, and for some of us, perhaps rediscovering, grace in the parables of Jesus. Last week, Barry taught us from the parable of the lost sheep, found in Luke 15, and this morning, we're going to look at yet another parable found in this very same chapter. It's perhaps one of Jesus' most well-known parables. But let me begin with this. One of the things that you should know about me is that I love Broadway musicals. Growing up in the New York, New Jersey area, I got to see a whole lot of Broadway shows. But my most favorite show of all time is Les Miserables. Perhaps you've seen it, or you've read the book, or more likely, you have seen one of the many movie versions. Les Miserables is the story of a peasant named Jean Valjean who's sentenced to a 19-year term of hard labor for the crime of stealing bread. And over the years, Valjean hardens into a tough convict until long last he earns his release. Now, convicts in those days had to carry identity cards, and so no innkeeper would allow a convicted felon to spend the night. So for 4 long days, Valjean wanders the village roads seeking shelter against the weather. Until finally, a kind bishop has mercy on him and offers him shelter in his home. Well, that very night, Jean Valjean runs off with the bishop's silverware. He's caught by the police, about to be thrown into the prison. And the bishop has mercy on him. He extends grace to him. Valjean leaves the bishop's home and he commits yet another petty crime. But immediately he repents. He tries to make things right, but it's too late. The police are on the hunt for him again. Jean Valjean remembers the grace shown to him by that bishop, and he turns his life around. He becomes a wealthy and merciful businessman, a hero who adopts and loves and cares for the young orphan girl, Cosette. Now, all this time, a policeman named Javert is on the hunt for Jean Valjean. Javert is a man of the law, and he believes that Valjean must pay for his crimes. He's a self-righteous man who thinks he's so very different than Valjean. He always does the right thing. He always follows the rules. Yet, in his 20-year hunt for Jean Valjean, he never lives with joy. He always has to do the right thing. He can never get it wrong. And still, he finds no freedom in living like this. Les Miserables depicts for us 2 ways to live, 2 ways to find meaning and happiness in life. One way is to be a rule breaker, to do whatever you want, to live life by your own rules, to seek your own happiness. In the beginning of the story, Jean Valjean is a rule breaker. He does what he needs to do to achieve his happiness. The rules don't matter. All that matters is that he gets what he wants. Now, the other way to live is to be a rule keeper, to live a morally upright life, to always follow the rules. And Javert was a rule keeper. He's a self-righteous man who always does the right thing. He would never think of breaking the law. Now, each of us has tried to live in at least one of these 2 ways. Some of us are like the younger brother. We're these rule breakers. We do whatever we want, whenever we want. We seek our own happiness by pursuing our desires. But ultimately, it leads to pain and most often destruction in our lives. Now, others of us are rule keepers. We perhaps have grown up in the church our entire lives. We always do the right thing. We have this whole moral checklist, and we're awesome at checking things off. And we think, because we've been so good, that life ought to work out the way we want. But the only problem is, so often it doesn't. And we're angry about that. And yet others of us have gone between these 2 ways of living, being rule breakers and rule keepers in different seasons of our life. Now, the only problem is that neither way leads to life. So how should we live? What is the way to meaning, to freedom, to joy? Well, this morning, I want to look at a parable of Jesus found in Luke 15, 11 to 32. And here is what I believe Jesus is trying to show us. Grace redefines the way we live. Grace redefines the way we live. Now, most of us, if we have any sort of church background, and even if you don't, you are familiar with this parable, and you've heard it called the parable of the lost son, or the prodigal son. The word prodigal means spending money or resources freely and recklessly, being wastefully extravagant. Let me say that again. Prodigal means spending money or resources freely and recklessly, being wastefully extravagant. And here it only refers to the younger son, but that title doesn't capture the essence, the fullness of all that I believe Jesus is trying to teach us. You see, there are two sons in this story. So a better title would be the parable of the lost sons, plural. Each son is lost, and each represents one of these two ways to live. Now, the parable is broken up into two acts. Act one is focused on the lost younger brother. He's what we might consider to be the bad son, at least according to our standards. Act two is focused on the lost older brother. He's what we think of as being the good son. But in this parable, Jesus shows us that the best way to live is not by breaking the rules, nor by keeping the rules. No, the best way to live is by receiving the extravagant grace of the Father. You see, grace redefines the way we live. And so what I want to do this morning is to walk through this parable and to look at the way these two lost sons lived, and then to show you Jesus' point in this whole parable. That there's a better way to live. In fact, it's the only way to real life, freedom, to joy. And this is what Jesus offers us. But before we dive into the parable, we need to do a little bit of background work. So let's take a look at Luke 15, 1 to 2. If you have your Bibles open there, because that's where we're going to be. Luke 15, 1 to 2. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, Jesus is talking to two groups of people here. First, we have the tax collectors and sinners. And Israel is under the tyranny of the Roman Empire. Rome, it was this brutal regime who was raping, plundering, murdering all that were under their control. And tax collectors bought the right from Rome to take money from their own people to fund this oppressing army that had taken over their nation. They were despised and hated because they were traitors. No good Jew would associate with a tax collector. Well, then there were also the sinners. These were the outcasts. They were the deformed, the diseased, the lepers, the prostitutes. These were the rule breakers, the kind of people you wouldn't associate with. And as we walk through the story, we will see that they're represented by the lost younger brother. But those weren't the only people there. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law are there as well. And they have some thoughts about the tax collectors and sinners. Now, the Pharisees and the teachers are the religious rock stars. They are the cream of the crop. They're the most educated. They're the smartest guys out there. They know their Bible. They have memorized the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. So I don't care how many verses you know, they beat you. They give more. They pray more. They actually make up more rules so they could follow them. That's how much they love keeping the rules. They're rule keepers, and they love doing it. And as we walk through this story, we'll see that they're represented by the lost older brother. And take a look at how each of these groups responds to Jesus. The tax collectors and sinners, they're gathering around him. They're drawn to Jesus, to his teachings, to his ways. They're attracted to him. The Pharisees and the teachers are wondering how Jesus could associate with such people. Jesus welcomes them and he eats with them. And in this culture, to eat with someone was an invitation to intimacy and to friendship. It was a sign of acceptance, and Jesus welcomes these people. And the Pharisees are shocked that he would do such a thing. Doesn't he know who they are? Doesn't he know what they've done and where they've been? And Jesus directs his teachings to these two groups of people. So let's take a look. Act one is the lost younger brother, the rule breaker. Let's take a look at Luke 15, 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them." The story begins with an alarming request. The younger brother asks for his share of the estate. Now, in those days, when the father died, the oldest son would receive a double portion of the inheritance. So if the father had two sons, the oldest would get two-thirds, and the younger one would get one-third. But that would only happen upon the father's death. The younger son here asks for his inheritance while his father is still alive. And this is a sign of incredible disrespect. By making this request, what the younger son is saying is, Father, I wish you were dead. I wish you were no longer alive. He wants the father's stuff. He just doesn't want a relationship with his father. By asking for this, the younger son rejects his father. Now, this is a patriarchal society, and respect for your elders, especially for your parents, was held in high value. And so a traditional father in this culture would respond to such a request by driving out his son with physical force. He would throw him out of the house. But this father doesn't do that. Instead, he divides his property between his sons. Now, to understand how significant that is, we need to know that the Greek word used for property here is the word bios. It's where we get the word biology from. It means life. And so what Luke is telling us is that the father divides his very life between his sons. You see, the father's wealth isn't tied up in stocks and mutual funds. It's tied up in land, in real estate, in animals. And so to give the younger son his share of the inheritance, he must sell everything he has. He must sell his land. Now, in our culture today, we don't understand the significance of the relationship that people had with land. Land was held in families for generations. My parents are Indian immigrants. They've been in this country for over 45 years. And my dad is the oldest living male in his family. And so my family still owns some land in India that has been in our family for generations. And a few years ago, he came to the conclusion that he would never return to live in India, nor would his children. And so what would he do with this land? And even though he knew he would never go back, that we would never go back, he found it so hard to part with this land. Because this land had been part of who he is. It was tied to the identity of our family. For generations, my family has lived on this little piece of land. And to lose your land was to almost lose a part of yourself. It was to lose your standing in the community. It meant everything. And this is what this father does. The younger brother is rejecting his father, his family, and his community. He's asking the father to almost rip apart his very life. And the father, instead of throwing him out of the house, instead of beating him, he responds by giving him what he asked for because he loves his son. Now, Jesus' listeners would have never seen a father like this. This goes against all their cultural norms and values. Out of love for his son, he grants his request. He gives him freedom to reject a relationship with his father. Now, usually when someone we love rejects us, we do a couple things. We respond maybe by getting angry, or we respond by trying to hurt that person back the way we feel like we've been hurt, or we just try to stop caring because that hurts too much. That's not what this father does. The father patiently suffers the shame and dishonor of his son's actions. He bears the pain of being rejected by his boy. He bears the pain of rejected love. And so the son goes off to this far-off land. He squanders his wealth in wild living, and then a famine hits and he's in trouble. Now, you would think at this point that he'd just come back home, but that's not what he does. You see, the younger brother can't return home because not only had he broken a relationship with his father, but he had broken his relationship with his community. And he is despised and looked down upon them. The entire community knows what this younger son has done to his father. And so he is cut off from them. He's no longer one of them. He's penniless and destitute. And so he lands a job feeding pigs. Now, there could be no worse job for a Jew. This goes against all his religious values. Pigs were considered to be unclean animals. And here was this younger son longing to fill his stomach with the slop of these filthy animals. No one to help him, no one to give him anything to eat. He had finally hit rock bottom. And the Pharisees and the teachers are listening to this story and they are loving it. Because the rule breakers are getting what they deserve. They like where Jesus is going with this. And the tax collectors and sinners, they're listening as well. And they get it. They know what it's like to mess up, to be desperate, and to be alone. Let's get back to the parable, picking up at verse 17. When he came to his senses, He said, how many of my father's hired servants had food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. The younger son comes up with a plan. He will go back to his father. He'll admit that he was wrong, that he sinned against him and against God, and that he's no longer worthy of being his son. And he will ask his father to hire him as a servant. Now, the son has brought shame and dishonor to his father, to his family, to his community. And if you violated the community's rules and standards, you had to make amends. And so the son intends to make up for what he has lost. His plan is to go to his father and say, Father, I've sinned against you. I violated the rules of our community. I don't deserve to be your son or to be part of this family. But if you would hire me as one of your servants, and I will work for you, and one day, Father, I will repay you for what I have lost. And so he practices his speech until he feels like he's got it just right, and he works up the courage to go home. And the Pharisees are listening, and they agree with the son's speech. They agree with his plan. Rule breakers must be punished. They must pay for their sins. And the tax collectors and sinners, they're listening as well, and they're wondering just how much it will cost them. What do they have to do to make up for what they've done? And then Jesus does what he's so masterful at doing. He blows up all their models, all their paradigms that they've set up for how to live. Picking back up at verse 20. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And then the son said to his father, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead, and he's alive again. He was lost, and he's been found. And so they began to celebrate. As a younger son returns home to his village, even while he's still a long way off, the father sees him, and he's filled with compassion, and he runs to him. He's not just power walking here. He is full on running. He is sprinting. And in this culture, a man of his age, a man of his status, always walked with a slow, dignified manner. A man like him would never run. Children run, young people run, women run. Not the patriarch of a family. But he runs out to his son because he knows what his son will face as he walks through that village to get home. He wants to save his son from shame. And so he humiliates himself. He runs to his boy. He throws his arms around him and he kisses him. And the younger son is shocked by his father's actions. He can't believe what's happening. And he tries to give his speech a go, but he can't even get it out. The father isn't interested in repayment or restitution. His son has come home. Quick, he says, bring the best robe, put a ring on his finger, put sandals on his feet. And the best robe in the house would have been the father's robe. The ring is the signet ring of the family, and only slaves go barefoot. And so the boy is clothed with his father's robe. He has the signet ring of his family and sandals on his feet as a sign of being restored, of being brought back into the family. And what the father is saying is this, son, you will not repay me. You can't earn your way back into our family. I am taking you back. You are my son. And then he tells the servants to prepare a feast, to bring the fattened calf, because they had to celebrate. Now, in this culture, meat was a delicacy. It was reserved only for the most special occasions. And the choicest meat, the most expensive meat, was the fattened calf. A party like this almost never happened. There is food and drink. And listen, this isn't box wine. This is the good stuff that the father's rolling out. This is a party to end all parties. And the entire village would have been invited. And so there's music and there's dancing to celebrate that this son has come home. But that's not all of the story. Let's move on to Act 2. Act 2 is the lost older brother, the rule keeper. Now, the older brother's out in the field, and as he gets closer, he begins to hear music and dancing. This is an epic party. I mean, music is blaring, people are on the dance floor, and the son asks one of his servants, what's going on? And the servant tells him, your brother has come home, and your father has received him as his son. He's back in your family. They've been reconciled. And so your father's throwing a party to celebrate. And how does the older brother respond? Picking back up at verse 28. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." The older brother is infuriated and he refuses to go inside. To not be present while his father throws a feast like this is a public insult to his father. It's humiliating. But why is the older son so angry? The father has divided all that he has between his two sons, and so everything that's left is legally the property of the older brother. The father has a right to throw the party. He's still the head of the family, but it's costly, and it comes at the expense of the older brother because it's his wealth that is diminished by such a feast. Now, the older son has insulted his father, and so what you would expect is that the father would punish him or condemn him for his behavior. But that's not what this father does. Out of love for his son, the father goes out to him. He pleads with him. He begs him. And then the older brother has some words for his father. And notice that even when he speaks to him, he doesn't address him by calling him father, which is highly disrespectful in this culture. He's basically saying this: "Look, you, all these years I slaved for you. I never disobeyed you. I did everything you wanted me to do. I've worked hard for you. And this son of yours comes back after wasting our money and God knows what, and you throw a party for him? He doesn't deserve this. He hasn't earned this. Not like me." And the father responds, "My son, you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." He responds in love and tenderness, even though his son has publicly insulted and shamed him. He says, "Son, come inside. Join me in this celebration. I will never abandon your brother, but I won't abandon you either. Don't you see that we had to celebrate? Your brother was dead and he's alive. He was lost and is found. How can we not be glad?" And this is where Jesus leaves the story. He never tells his listeners what happened. Did the older brother go in? Was he reconciled with his family? Or did the older brother remain outside, still angry and feeling like he'd been treated unfairly? Jesus wrecks all our ideas about the way to live. So what's he trying to teach us? Let me offer you two observations. Here's observation one: grace is freely available to all. What Jesus is saying to the tax collectors and to the Pharisees and the teachers, to the sinners, was that no matter what you've done, no matter where you've been, there is no sin that's a match for the grace of God. You cannot out-sin God's love for you. You just can't do it. And in this parable, the father doesn't wait until the son cleans himself up and earns his way back. No, he runs to his son, he throws his arms around him, and he kisses him. And God doesn't wait for us to clean ourselves up either. He doesn't wait for us to figure out our lives. He runs to us. In Jesus Christ, God came near. Paul writes this in Romans 5:8, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were still in our sin and shame, while we were still in our mess, Christ died for us." And so now, if we have put our faith in Jesus Christ, we are the sons and daughters of God. Some of us are younger brothers. We're rule breakers. We've made a mess of our lives. We search for unconditional love, and we realize that what the world offers us comes up so very short. We've done what we wanted to do to find our happiness, and it hasn't worked. The only way to real, meaningful, soul-satisfying life is through a relationship with the Father, and this comes by receiving the extravagant grace of the Father. Henry Nouwen says this: "One of the greatest challenges of the spiritual life is to receive God's forgiveness. There's something in us humans that keeps us clinging to our sins and prevents us from letting God erase our past and offer us a completely new beginning. Receiving forgiveness requires a total willingness to let God be God and do all the healing, all the restoring. all the renewing. Some of us are younger brothers, and others of us are older brothers. And we've tried to earn our way to God by being good, by being rule keepers, and we're just as lost as the younger brother. We too have rejected a relationship with God, and like the younger brother, we want the stuff that God gives us more than we want God. Sure, we show up to church, maybe we even serve, but we do it as a way to put God in our debt. We think that because we've kept all the rules, God owes us a good life. And when things don't go the way we want, we get angry. You see, older brothers suffer from this constant low-grade anger deep in their souls because they seek to control God by being obedient and doing all the right things. There have been moments in my life where I have been the younger brother. And there have been moments in my life where I have been the older brother. And just recently, I found myself living like the older brother. I moved here to Dallas 4 years ago to go to seminary. And prior to that, I had a successful career in corporate finance for 15 years. And I loved what I did, and I was actually pretty good at it. I had a comfortable life, and I love being comfortable. But I knew that God was calling me to ministry. And so I quit my job, and I moved out here to Dallas, and I became an unemployed student for 2 years. Until I graduated and I came on staff here full time. And over the past few months, life just hasn't been easy for me in a number of different ways. It just hasn't been easy. And I found myself angry at God. And it wasn't this sort of outright aggressive anger. It was this low grade seething in my soul because I felt like God owed me. See, I felt like, God, I've given everything up for you. And here's the thing. When you have the heart of an older brother, your anger, your resentment, your bitterness often leads you to have an exaggerated perspective on life. See, I hadn't given everything up. I am not poor and destitute. I am not living on ramen noodles. It's actually okay. But I felt like, God, I've given everything up for you. The least you could do is make life easy for me. God, you owe me. You see what I've done for you? You owe me. And when I recognized the posture and the attitude of my heart towards the God of the universe, who is my good Father, I had to confess and repent of my sin. See, I had to let the truth of the gospel sink deeper and deeper into my heart. I had to return home to my Father, to receive the extravagant grace of the Father. Because regardless of the circumstances of my life, Jesus is better. His grace is more than I deserve, and it's all that I need. Look right at me. The Father loves and accepts you. He does. You don't have to work for it. You cannot earn it. Stop acting like a slave when you're a son. Stop acting like a servant when you are a beloved child. Grace redefines the way we live. Let's move on to observation 2. Grace is costly. Grace is costly. While grace is freely available to us, it was costly to God. Grace isn't cheap. While the word prodigal has been used to describe the younger son, it's a more fitting description of the father. The father is the one who is recklessly extravagant with his love. In this parable, it cost the father. All that he had, he freely gave to the younger son. And when the son returns home, after losing his inheritance, the father runs to him. Without regard for his honor, the father humiliates himself to save his younger son from the humiliation he would suffer at the hands of the community. And the father also suffers from the shame and dishonor that the older son brings upon him by not coming to the party. The father degrades himself by going out to his son and pleading with him to come in. Both sons had rejected a relationship with the father, yet the father looks for them. The father goes out to them. The father runs to them. And this is what God has done for us through Jesus Christ. God gave his son so that you and I can become sons and daughters. The younger brother could only be brought back into the family at great expense to the older brother. Now, a true older brother would have seen the pain and the suffering of his father, and he would have gone out looking for his younger brother, and he would not have come home without finding him, no matter what the expense. Jesus is our older brother. It cost Jesus his life. He gave his life so that we might have life. Jesus gave his life to bring us home. Here's how Tim Keller puts it. Mercy and forgiveness must be free and unmerited to the wrongdoer. If the wrongdoer has to do something to merit it, then it isn't mercy. But forgiveness always comes at a cost to the one granting the forgiveness. When we recognize what it costs God to bring us home, when we realize the glorious, scandalous grace that the Father has lavished upon us, it ought to change the way we live. Let's go back to the story of Jean Valjean. And rather than me just telling you about it, I thought it'd be better if you actually saw it. So let's take a look at this scene and a beautiful picture of grace.
Is anybody there? So we'll use wooden spoons. I don't want to hear anything more about it.
I'm sorry to disturb you.
You caught him.
But I had my eye on this man.
Oh, thank God. I'm very angry with you, Jean Valjean.
What happened to your eye, Monseigneur?
Didn't he tell you he was our guest last night?
Oh, yes. After we searched his knapsack and found all this silver, he claimed... that you gave it to him.
Yes. Of course I gave him the silverware. But why didn't you take the candlesticks? That was very foolish. Madame Gillot, fetch the silver candlesticks. They're worth at least 2,000 francs. Why did you leave them? Hurry. Monsieur Valjean has to get going. He's lost a lot of time. Did you forget to take them?
Are you saying he told us the truth?
Of course. Thank you for bringing him back. I'm very relieved.
Release him.
You're really letting me go?
Didn't you understand the bishop?
Madame Gillot, offer these men some wine. They must be thirsty.
Thank you.
Don't forget. Don't ever forget. You've promised to become a new man.
Promise? Why are you doing this?
Jean Valjean, my brother, you no longer belong to evil. With this silver, I've bought your soul. I've ransomed you from fear and hatred. And now I give you back to God.
Jean Valjean runs off with the bishop's silverware. He's caught by the police, about to be thrown into the prison. And the bishop has mercy on him. He extends grace to him. And in the same way the bishop showed grace to Valjean, so God extends grace to us through Jesus Christ. Jesus gave his life to buy us back, to redeem us from sin and death. It's as if when Jesus rose from the dead, he grabs us by the shoulders and he says, with my life, I've ransomed you from fear and hatred, sin and every evil. And now, brother, now, sister, I give you back to God. And we get to do the same for others. Because we've experienced grace, we get to extend grace. Because we are loved and accepted by God, we can love and accept others. We get to grab people by the shoulders and say, brother, sister, husband, wife, friend, I give you back to God. In every conversation, through every interaction, we get to be the hands and feet of Jesus. Grace redefines the way we live. Jesus is talking to tax collectors and sinners. He's talking to Pharisees and teachers. He's talking to younger brothers and older brothers. And he's showing us that the way to live is the reckless grace of the Father. To receive the extravagant grace of the Father. Regardless of how you came into this room this morning, whether you are a younger brother or an older brother, this grace, this glorious, scandalous grace is available to each of us. And this grace cost the Father. Jesus gave his life to bring us home. And as those who have experienced grace, we get to extend grace to those around us. And as we respond this morning to this extravagant grace, by coming to the table, here's what I'd ask you to reflect on. How are you living? Are you living like the younger brother? Doing whatever you want? Living life by your own rules? Seeking your happiness by pursuing your desires? Maybe that's not you. Are you living like the older brother? Trying to do all the right things to keep all the rules? As a way of getting God to do what you want? Or maybe you're some combination of the two. There's a better way. In fact, it's the only way to real life, real joy, real freedom. Receive the extravagant grace of the Father. The Father is calling you to come home. He's pleading with you to come home. You don't have to live like this. Return home to your Father. Come home. Come home to your Father. And so, as we come to the table this morning to remember and to celebrate this glorious, scandalous grace, if you're here this morning and for whatever reason you can't navigate the steps, simply slip up your hand and one of our ushers will come and serve you the elements right where you are. As you come to the front, you may want to kneel and pray and light a candle. You can light an amber candle as a symbol of a prayer that you're offering to God. Perhaps it's a prayer entrusting yourself to the grace of the Father. Perhaps it's a prayer of repentance, returning home to your Father. Or maybe you're sitting here this morning and you've never actually put your trust in Jesus Christ. Friend, this moment is for you. Jesus died to bring you home. The Father is waiting with open arms for you to come home. Come home to your Father. You can talk to God right where you are, right where you're seated. You can tell him you want to put your trust in Jesus and the work that he did for you on the cross as the only means of salvation. But you're also welcome to come here to the front and light a red candle as a symbol of your new relationship with God, who is your good Father. And we would love to celebrate that with you. There will also be men and women available here at the front with blue candles who would love to talk and to pray with you. So on the night on which he was betrayed, Jesus took the bread, and after he had given thanks, he broke it. And he said, "This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup and he said, "This cup is the cup of the new covenant. You now have new access to God through my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me." And Paul says that as often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we proclaim the Lord's death. We proclaim the gospel until he comes again. This is Jesus' table. He is the host of this meal, and he invites you to come.